This is the Nuance Podcast by Medicine Explained. We're your hosts, Amanda
and Dan.
We talk to experts on health, the human experience, and the intersection of climate and human health.
We explore the nuance that's been lost in today's conversation. We don't take ads because we want to keep our information unbiased.
But we do need your support. So leave a review on Apple or Spotify.
And share with your friends or on social media.
When people think of the water crisis, we think of it as an international problem. We do not think of the more than 2.2 million Americans that still don't have clean, running water or working toilets in their home. In today's conversation, we chat with co-founder and CEO of DigDeep.org, George McGraw. George founded DigDeep to help those communities in America build and manage their own water systems. They've brought clean, running water to thousands of families on the Navajo Nation, Appalachia, and Texas border colonias. DigDeep also conducts groundbreaking research, empowers communities to advocate for their rights, and teaches Americans to use their resources more intelligently. It is the only nonprofit focused on closing the water access gap here at home. George received his master's in international law and conflict management from the United Nations University for Peace. He's a leading voice in social entrepreneurship, environmental justice, and water, and co-authored the first national report on water access, Closing the Water Access Gap in the United States. In this conversation, we talk about what the water access gap is and why it is so important to have access to running water and sanitation. George explains how race and income impact communities' access to water. He explains the economic and health impact of the water access gap and how climate change is affecting access to water. He shares stories of how DigDeep's work is impacting people and how we can get involved in helping to ensure a fundamental human right for everyone, access to clean, running water. Hi, George. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to chat with you. I think we've been trying to make this conversation happen for maybe over a year now, but it's well worth the wait. And welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Amanda. Yeah, I'm psyched too.
Awesome. So I did record an introduction for you, but I really do love when people introduce themselves because there's some nuances that we miss in that. So just do you mind telling our audience who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. My name is George McGraw. I'm the CEO and founder at DigDeep.org, and we help get running water and flush toilets to the 2.2 million Americans who still don't have them. My background is in international human rights law, and I'm a water expert kind of broadly. I also serve as the Water and Power Commissioner, one of the Water and Power Commissioners here in Los Angeles, where we both live.
Amazing. And there's two questions that come out of that intro already. What is DigDeep and how did you find this passion for water and water rights?
Well, I'll answer your second question first. So water has, I mean, a lot of my friends, you know, we live in Los Angeles, astrologically, water is all over my chart. I'm deeply a water person. I've always lived by water. I always felt really connected to water. I was like that kid. You know, your mom would take you to the zoo and she'd go buy the tickets and she'd turn around and all of a sudden I'm like sort of stripped naked playing in the fountain at the entrance. And, you know, like many people who grew up with some privilege, which I did in the Midwest, I had no idea there were so many billions of people without access to basic water resources and basic sanitation across the world. And I was so sort of floored to start learning about the global water crisis in college that I ended up dedicating the rest of my time in college and eventually in law school to solving that problem. And so my first crack at it was in countries like South Sudan and Cameroon. And it wasn't until well into my career that I got a call from a woman named Karen who said, you know, I want to give you a little bit of money, but I want you to help people here in the US. And that was the first time I discovered that there were people in our own country, you know, the richest democracy on earth, who get up every day and don't know where they'll get enough water to, you know, make it through the day. And so that's what DigDeep does. We help these thousands of families across the country in all 50 states who still don't have access to the taps and the toilets that the rest of us often take for granted. And we do that by building infrastructure in rural communities in places like the Texas border colonias and Appalachia on the Navajo Nation. We do policy advocacy work. We, you know, partner with other organizations across our sector to strengthen this approach that we take. We do a lot of generative data and research work. And we also just do a lot of communications work like this, trying to get the word out about the problem.
Wow, that's amazing. I actually, my first project that I was passionate about was building a well somewhere in rural Africa. And I saved up all of my piggy bank savings, and that's what I put it towards. So this has been a passion of mine as well. But it's still...
Let's just stay on that for a second. Like, isn't that incredible that like there's something about this resource that like really is so deeply intuitive to all of us? I mean, I was like you. I was that kid that was just so floored that someone didn't have clean water to drink, and I wanted to dedicate my life to solving it. Like, that's how passionate I was about it. And it seems like for a minute there, especially in like the late 90s, early 2000s, that like everybody's, you know, mom's cousin's granddaughter's Girl Scout troop was like raising money for a well in somewhere. And none of that work was getting done in the US or in other high income countries where it's still a problem. I think that's so interesting that we can feel so passionate about solving someone else's problems and just take for granted that, you know, they exist here in our own country.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that I want to touch on as well, because I think that in medicine, I've always wanted to do Doctors Without Borders and help underserved populations across the globe. But you realize how much inequity there is in our quote unquote developed country in the United States. And a lot of us don't even recognize that. So what is the water gap in the US, and how do we even have that? Like, why is that a thing?
Yeah, so it looks pretty much the same as it does in other countries. You know, you have, like I said, about 2.2 million people. And according to the last census data that we have, or the best census data we have, that number is probably growing for the first time in US history, especially as communities that once had access to water are losing it because of disinvestment or climate change impacts. But generally, you have these millions of Americans who, don't have basic water or sanitation infrastructure. So they generally wake up every morning, figure out where they're going to get enough clean water to make it through the day. If they can afford it, they buy bottled water at the store and bring it home. Many can't afford it, and so they shower in truck stops or school bathrooms, or they'll melt snow or pick a gallon or two of water out of a creek or a stream or a mine shaft, often water that is contaminated and will make their family sick. So these families experience much higher instances of waterborne illness, all sorts of other, you know, major economic impacts that we can talk about. And this doesn't even count the maybe 40 or 50 million more who have access to water at home, but their water doesn't meet basic safety standards. So we're just talking about like the core several million people in the US who don't have anything. And that's what we're really dedicated to closing at Dig Deep, is this U.S. water gap.
I actually did my medical school training in Louisiana. And if you go into rural Louisiana, sometimes you turn on the tap and the water comes out brown or yellow. So like you were saying, even if you have running water, it's not necessarily something you can use.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, and that's we're starting to see that more and more in bigger cities too. You know, boil water advisories, you turn on the tap and something comes out that you don't expect. I think Ben Franklin said, you know, you don't know the worth of the water till the well runs dry. I think in a lot of ways, the communities that we serve are kind of the canaries in the coal mine, and more Americans every year are experiencing this. But, you know, climate change impacts, like the rest of the water access gap, are really happening along racial and socioeconomic lines. If you're Indigenous in the US, you're 19 times more likely than a white family to live in the water gap. If you're Black or Latino, you're twice as likely. And, you know, the climate change impacts that are knocking the systems offline are impacting, you know, rural, more marginalized, poor, and often non-white populations more often.
How is climate change impacting water access?
Well, let me count the ways. It's honestly, obviously, it's like really complex, right? The way climate change is impacting our life in general, it's impacting everything. But you can't just say everything. So I'm gonna give you a few specific examples. In some places, it's making groundwater harder to find. On the Navajo Nation, for instance, where about a third of people haul water every day, about 90% of surface water resources have disappeared in the last 100 years. They've you know, desertified, fallen deeper underground, or dried up. And that means it's much more difficult for families who used to just leave their house and be able to find water to get the water they need to live every day. It's making things like wildfires more common. A lot of the communities we work in don't have water to fight fires with, and so they have to watch their livelihoods kind of burn up in front of them. It's changing the incidence of disease and contributing to new disease outbreaks and the mutations of diseases. And, you know, without basic sanitation in the places we work, it's really difficult to protect yourself from any sort of disease or outbreak. We saw disease rates in places like, again, the Navajo Nation, the Texas colonias, rural Appalachia, much, much higher than other parts of the country where you could wash your hands and stay home, you know, not have to leave to collect water at a busy store or a gas station. Let's see, climate change is causing seawater to infiltrate further into groundwater, sometimes, you know, poisoning groundwater supplies or making them more difficult to use. In other places, it's causing flooding that can, you know, wipe out your wastewater infrastructure and take human sewage and throw it across your yard and into your basement and make you and your family sick, especially if what you're relying on is just a pipe out of your house into a local stream or river. There are so many ways that we're just beginning to understand that the climate change crisis is really impacting water and sanitation access. It's something that we're devoting a lot of time at Dig Deep with our partners at the Pacific Institute to studying. We're in the process of finishing the first national study on that exact question right now.
How realistic is Mad Max?
I don't think very realistic. I mean, we're not entering, like, you know, climate change isn't one thing. I think we have evolved the conversation successfully as a country beyond this idea of just global warming. In some places, it's going to look like cooling. In some places, it's going to look like a lot more water than less. I mean, you live in Santa Monica. I'm here in central Los Angeles. I mean, we've seen more rain in the last couple of years than is normal for us because we're starting to see these atmospheric rivers. And those are presenting big challenges for us over at the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, you know, where I serve as water commissioner. It's knocking some of our infrastructure offline. We had major damage done to the LA Aqueduct, which delivers a lot of our drinking water from a northern part of the state. You know, it's causing all sorts of system failures in power and in water, as the amount of wastewater we're trying to clear from streets and neighborhoods is more than ever before. So yeah, I don't think it's all going to be Mad Max, but everywhere is going to experience this in one way or another, and it's going to be new. And in a lot of places, the systems are really specifically built to handle what we're used to, and it'll be difficult to flex them to handle something new.
Yeah, I grew up in Washington State, and so we were used to rain, and the infrastructure is built to handle rain. But it's really interesting to see how LA has responded to the rain that we don't usually get. I mean, we essentially live on all of concrete, and I live close to the ocean, so I see so much runoff into the ocean and so much flooding, even with the small amounts of rain that we are getting. Obviously, it's more for the region, but it's interesting that there's this theme, like there can be either too much water or too little water, but water is at the base of what we're dealing with right now.
Well, it's really interesting in Los Angeles. I think, you know, we have the LA River, right? Which is where you're seeing all that water exit the city into the Santa Monica Bay. And the sort of prevailing focus for a long time was, if the drop of water hits the ground in Los Angeles, get it out as fast as possible. Because the amount of vertical feet that the LA River falls between its origin and the ocean, which is a very small distance, is the same amount of vertical feet the entire Mississippi falls as it runs the length of the country. So every time it would rain here, we'd have these massive floods that would destroy people's homes and livelihoods and take a lot of lives. And so with the help of the Army Corps and others, we channelized the LA River and we got rid of that problem. But, you know, that was the time where we thought water was abundant. I mean, there was a time we were developing human rights criteria after World War II, and we didn't even consider water among the basic human rights that we wanted to outline and protect because we all just took it for granted. But now it's about holding on to that water once it hits the ground. We know it's key for our survival as a city and as a species. So, you know, the city family across all sorts of different departments has been implementing these massive infrastructure projects to capture, to process that stormwater, to filter it back into the groundwater and recharge our basin. I think in this last series of storms over the last couple of weeks, we captured something like 14 billion gallons of water and fed it back underground. So there's amazing progress being made there. And Los Angeles, like many cities, is showing an incredible amount of creativity as it develops more resilient you know, practices to help us manage the impacts of climate change. But we do have a lot to do as a country and as a city.
Yeah. And I mean, we live in LA and there's a lot of resources here. So we're able to adapt and become resilient to these changes a little bit faster than some communities might. So I would love to talk about the three projects that you have for Dig Deep, the Navajo Water Project, the Appalachia Water Project, and the Colonias Water Project. Do you mind just touching on a couple of those? And how do you choose the communities to help with Dig Deep?
Absolutely. So yeah, water access projects are really the beating heart of our work. So the majority of our staff, their focus every day is to get running water and flushing toilets to people who sometimes have never had them before or haven't had them for a while. And we do that work, like you said, on Navajo Nation, which takes up parts of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. We do it in the Texas border colonias, which are these informal settlements along the U.S.-Mexico border. Primarily, we work in the El Paso area now. And we do it in rural parts of Appalachia, in West Virginia, and in Kentucky. And each of those projects looks a little bit different. The lived experience of people living there, you know, is sort of the same. You know, they leave their house every day and they collect water wherever they can get it, and they make it stretch and they kind of get by. The reasons for what those people are experiencing are different in every place. On Navajo, it's a lack of historic investment. It's structural racism. It's the reservation system. In the Texas border colonias, again, structural racism is at play there, but it really has to do with, you know, laws not adequately protecting people from unfair land development practices, these predatory lending practices that built neighborhoods that don't have access to running water when everyone else around them does. And in Appalachia, you have some towns and counties that were the richest in the country 100 years ago, but where, because of our energy transition, major corporations have left and there's no one, you know, there to keep the system running. And so it falls offline and people now for a generation have been without running water and have been getting by on boil water advisory notices and water coming out of mine shafts and mountain springs. So yeah, each of those places is a little different, and the sort of solutions that we implement in each place is different, whether we're building on-grid connections to water and sanitation systems, whether we're building off-grid systems in places that are really remote that might store water underground and use solar power to pump it into a house, for instance, whether we're building neighborhood scale sanitation systems or single bathrooms with septic systems. You know, it looks a little different in every place, but in every place, the result is the same, you know, clean, safe running water and sustainable sanitation for a family.
I love that you have a goal that's pretty much the same throughout, but each of the way that you implement the projects that you're doing is different, which is so important in creating solutions for communities, is really engaging the community, seeing what resources you have in the area, seeing exactly what the community needs instead of, you know, just doing a one size fits all. So why is it so important to have relationships with the community, and what have you learned from that process?
Well, in a lot of ways, we are the communities that we serve. More than 40% of staff here at Dig Deep have lived without running water or sanitation ourselves at some point in our lives. Some people still live in places that don't have it, actually. And that's because we hire from within the communities we serve and we build local teams. I think that is so important. I mean, we are an incredibly diverse organization. And while the problem might look or feel the same sometimes in these different geographies or cultural contexts, the solutions are really more successful if they are led by the communities they serve, and if they can be sort of understood and championed by those folks. And there's no better person than someone from that community to ensure that process happens and happens equitably. So yeah, we build these teams from inside places like Appalachia, the Texas Colonias, Navajo Nation. And those teams deeply engage communities on their challenges, potential solutions, everything from engineering drawings to, you know, the lived experience in someone's house and how it impacts their household income. And we use all that data to co-design and co-implement solutions that will last. And the level of sort of buy-in we have from these communities is, I mean, it's massive.
Yeah, I love that. And some things that you've mentioned throughout this conversation is that the impact of the access to water on multiple parts of our lives. So part of the reason why I was so inspired when I was young to help fund a well is not only is it crazy that some people do not have access to running water, It's the fact that a lot of women were not able to be educated because they had to go out and walk miles and miles and bring water back home. So that was the main thing that they did during the day. So how can access to water impact our lives? And maybe we can start with public health.
Yeah, great. This is really interesting because a couple years ago now, we released the first economic impact study on the water access gap in the US. It's called Draining. You can find it on our website. And we tried to quantify exactly this question, like how is this impacting people's daily lives? And then we tried to quantify the dollar impact, really make that real for people. Kind of in the same way that you saw that, especially for women and girls, you know, there is this time lost. Well, that has an economic impact, right? On those women and girls and their families, their ability to develop wealth and economic security. So we approached it from that lens. And what we found was that every year we allow the water access gap to stay open in the U.S., we lose almost $9 billion in economic growth. And that's across several different indicators. You mentioned health. So almost $1 billion of that are physical health costs. That's like, you know, that's people getting sick from a higher incidence of waterborne illness. It's people developing a higher rate of type 2 diabetes. Sometimes, I mean, something like 36,000 cases of type 2 diabetes every year in the U.S. could be completely avoided if people had running water, so they would be less dependent on sugary beverages. And in terms of the public health impact, that also has a major mental health cost. I think something like $200 million every year of mental health spending to help people combat anxiety and depression because they don't have access to running water. But it does go beyond public health. I know we can come back and talk about that more, but you have the amount that every family spends on things like bottled water every year, something like $1,300 per family. And then you have the big chunk of money is the time these folks have lost going to their jobs or getting an education because they've been out hauling water or they've been sick with a waterborne illness. And those impacts, when you put them all together, they have these what economists call knock-on impacts to GDP. Like they roll up to have an even bigger impact on a local economy because they pull people out of business, they pull money away from economic activity. They have an impact of almost an extra $1 billion a year to the US economy from those economic impacts alone.
Wow, $9 billion. That's something that I can't even wrap my mind around. That's such a large number.
I know, it's something like... almost $16,000 per family, which in many cases is more than that family is going to make in a year.
Oh my gosh. Well, so story is always so important and resonates with people. Do you mind sharing a couple of stories of how access to running water has changed someone's life?
Sure. I love to tell the story of this woman named Brenda Johnson, who was one of the first people I met when we started working on the Navajo Nation. I showed up one day on the back of a water truck that this community had been sort of informally organizing to visit people's homes and drop off water. And we pulled up and they opened the spout on the side of the truck and people flooded out the house with barrels and buckets and pickle jars and cups and mugs, anything that would hold like a drop of water. And they filled everything they could up and they sort of placed them all around the house for use over the next couple of weeks. And I filled up some cooking pans and I followed this woman into her kitchen where she was making tamales. And I said, "Oh, this is so nice. You're making tamales. Are you having family over?" And she said, "No, I actually make these tamales and I put them in this cooler and I walk down the hill and I sell them. And this is how I get gas money." And she explained to me that it had been a few weeks since they got water last. And in that time, her husband, who was the primary breadwinner of the household, he was injured at work. He smashed his foot. And without water at home to keep it clean, his wound had gotten infected. He contracted gangrene and actually had been taken to a hospital 50 miles away where he was treated and eventually released. And by the time I got there, he'd already been released a few days, maybe 5 or 6 days. And Brenda said, you know, no running water means no tamales, and no tamales means no gas money, and no gas money means I can't go get my husband. And he's just sitting there on the streets of Gallup, New Mexico, not only kind of just trying to get by, but also not making money for our family and not keeping us safe. And, you know, Brenda's other concern was her aged mother, Lindsay Johnson, who was living with them and was managing kidney failure. And she was on dialysis. And right about the time we got to the house, the Department of Public Health had decided that, you know, Lindsay could no longer live with her family because they couldn't keep her safe without electricity and running water. And so we hustled the first few months. This was years ago, almost 10 years ago, working on Navajo to get clean water to this family so that Lindsay could be reunited with her family, grow old, and eventually pass, you know, in community with her family. And watching water over the last 10 years completely transform that family's life has been such a joy. It's really crazy, all the things water touches. You take it for granted, but then you give it to someone and you watch them transform, and it is so joyful.
Wow, that is so impactful and really eye-opening, because as family medicine doctors, we really try to be aware of the psychosocial aspect of someone's health, not just, you know, what is your marker for diabetes right now, but will you have the ability to make it to your appointment, stuff like that. And oh, yeah. Never have I thought about access to water. Never have I asked my patients, do you have a easily accessible water? So we may be discharging someone home, like you said, with an infection that may honestly get worse because they can't keep it clean. So thank you for sharing those stories.
Well, can I give you a couple other examples of how that's come up, that exact problem?
Please do.
You know, so a few others just from Navajo, and this happens across all of our sites, but I think because of how prevalent lack of access to water is on Navajo, those health systems are asking that question. And it often leads to some really difficult outcomes. We worked several years after we got water to Brenda and Lindsay and their family. We worked with the family of this little girl named baby Lisa. And she had been born with microvillous inclusion disease, basically couldn't process food because the microvilli in her digestive system weren't functioning properly. And she needed an intestinal transplant. This was days after she was born. So very quickly, it was determined she was going to die without this transplant. And they found an organ donor. And they life flighted her to Phoenix, where she was going to get the surgery. And she was being prepped on the operating table. And her parents were having this, you know, public health intake interview. And they asked, you know, what's your home like? You know, how are you going to care for her? And they found out that the family didn't have electricity, didn't have running water. And so they canceled the surgery. And it would be like 5 or 6 more years that child would have to live in nursing care, 5 hours from her family, you know, with major medical and developmental challenges because she couldn't get the right level of nutrition, while the family worked to solve that problem and find her a new organ. And it was causing so much stress. I remember the level of just like angst and desperation that those parents felt just trying to get their baby the basics, literally years of like never-ending fighting. And I've seen this at special needs schools where we've got brought clean water for the first time, where students with like massive medical and developmental disabilities were being bathed with bottled water, and their, you know, sensitive medical equipment, things like trach tubes and feeding tubes, were being cleaned with bottled water. Yeah, it does have a really massive public health impact that I think a lot of us don't think about.
Wow. Oh my gosh. I can't even imagine what those parents were going through.
Yeah.
So you have mentioned a couple of reasons why someone may be more susceptible, or communities may be more susceptible to not having access to running water. What are some of the common threads that you see in folks who don't have this access, or in communities that don't have this access?
I mentioned some of them earlier, but race is the strongest predictor of whether or not you and your family are going to have running water in 2024. Indigenous folks are 19 times more likely not to have it than white families. Black and Latino families are twice as likely. And then from there, it comes down to sort of economics, your income, and also your geography. You're more likely not to have running water if you are a rural minority, if you're low income. You know, that probably doesn't, it's probably not a major surprise for people, but these things really do matter.
Yeah. And even if they don't necessarily come as a surprise, I think we have to keep being reminded, because these are common themes throughout the inequities in the U.S. that we see today.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And by the way, this is in all 50 states, and it's probably happening in a county or town close to you. I think we take for granted that this, you know, probably happens in some rural part of the country so far away from me. But, you know, we have people right here in Los Angeles County that are experiencing this.
Mm-hmm. And as the summer comes around too, and it's getting hotter and hotter, that's more dangerous for folks as well.
Yeah, true.
And so you did mention that it's probably impacting someone who's either closely a neighbor to us in our community. Like you said, 2 million people who do not have access to running water. How can we, what can we do to help fix this issue?
Yeah, an awesome question. I always tell people, start with yourself. I think one of the challenges that we run into at Dig Deep, kind of motivating lawmakers, funders, the members of the public to do something about this, is that a lot of us have lost our connection to water as a resource. It comes out of our taps. We barely look at our water bills. It's cheap, it's abundant, it's clean for the vast majority of us. And so we take it for granted. So, you know, when people ask, you know, what can I do? How can I get involved? I always say, start with yourself. Take 24 hours, grab a water bottle, maybe a liter water bottle or like an old milk gallon or something. Fill it up and try to just get through 24 hours on a gallon of water, about 4 liters. That's the amount of water a lot of our clients use every day. They stretch it to brush their teeth and cook their food and bathe their bodies. And because a lot of us have never experienced that, it's really difficult to have that emotional connection with them to know what this really feels like. And I'm not saying that, like, you know, that's the same as suffering, you know, for a lifetime without access to running water or sanitation, but it's an entry point. And once you've done that and gotten a deeper connection to the resource, I mean, it's pretty amazing how like this switch in your brain can kind of flip in 24 hours. Once you've done that, then see how best to get involved. I mean, a lot of people that get involved with Dig Deep, they sign up for our mailings and become sort of our ambassadors on social media, donate money, 100% of which goes directly to, you know, projects like our research and water access work. And there are probably organizations, you know, working in your area that are starting to care about these issues. We're building a bigger and bigger network of hundreds now of organizations around the country that touch water and sanitation in some way. And we're starting to convene them to work on these issues collaboratively. So if you're involved in any sort of, you know, public health, neighborhood council, anti-homelessness, any organization like those in your area, you're probably already working on water and sanitation issues. Ask what they are and how these nonprofits you already support are approaching them, and see if you can get more involved.
Also, if you look through history, one of the biggest impacts in public health was sanitation and access to, to clean water. That made a huge impact on people's lives and our average life expectancy.
Yeah, that's so true. And so to see that kind of investment that we've made as a country in those systems getting lost now, you know, falling offline, that's so discouraging, because it really, that is the greatest strides we've made in public health have been when we got, you know, wastewater systems in place and started really tackling these major epidemics, things like cholera, diphtheria, typhoid, the kind of stuff that used to kill, you know, millions of people at a time, you know, are virtually unheard of now.
Mm-hmm. And what can policymakers be doing? Like, what kind of policies do we need to increase access to running water?
We're seeing policymakers start to make some real moves here. I mean, obviously investment is needed. I personally believe that the federal government has the biggest responsibility here. They're responsible because of the ways we've chosen to invest our money in rural America for this problem in a lot of the places we experience it. And they're also sort of the only actor that's big enough to kind of deal with the scale of this problem. Economists, I've learned, call this a wrong pockets problem, meaning you can't expect private individuals or companies or even small communities to invest in these systems themselves, because the returns aren't big enough to justify the investment. You really need the largest actor in the room, where most of the returns will accumulate, to make those investments. And we know that for every dollar we invest in water and sanitation systems, we see a $5 economic return. But most of that is felt at the national level in terms of GDP. And so we need the federal government to build more programs through things like the bipartisan infrastructure law, which passed during the Biden administration, through things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed to help us combat COVID and its economic impacts. We need to see more money from these programs and make it to the ground where people live and where people don't have access to water and sanitation. The other thing I'll say is we need better data. Right now, if you asked any of our federal partners, you know, how many people are there in the U.S. today without running water? They wouldn't be able to tell you with a lot of accuracy we use kind of proxies from things like the American Community Survey, a product of the census, to estimate how many households don't have improved plumbing across the United States. But those estimates are definitely undercounting the populations that we're serving, which tend to be rural minorities. Mm-hmm. We know that from the statistical data. And even at an undercount, it's still a very big number and the number is growing. So we need better, more actionable, more granular data. There's probably an effort that could be made at the federal level to just collect whatever data we do have across federal agencies like the Bureau of Agriculture, Department of Agriculture, the EPA, Reclamation. But probably we need to get better numbers from things like our census process that give us a clearer picture of who's facing this problem and what kind of challenge they're facing so that we can know how to tackle it, how much time it's going to take, what it's going to cost, and really make plans to solve this problem once and for all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was wondering, sometimes we look towards other countries or even states that have more progressive policies. Are there any countries or states that are doing something that you think is commendable at the policy level?
Yeah, it's interesting. The states that have been best at tackling their own water access gaps are often very poor states. And in those places, you see a lot of collaboration between the government and civil society, universities or research institutions, funders, and communities themselves. And generally, this collaboration is organized around what we call a WASH sector, Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene. The acronym is WASH. And these very diverse actors come together and they set really ambitious goals like, hey, in this region of the Middle East and North Africa, let's cut in half the amount of people without a toilet in the next 20 years. And then they'll say, okay, like we're going to cover this part. And you're going to cover this part. And by the way, we're going to share our data throughout. And we're going to spend these massive investments by foreign aid entities and also our own governments to get this done. And that kind of coordinated approach that is really driven by civil society, driven by communities themselves, and that involves all these diverse actors, we've never taken that kind of approach in the US. We don't have our own WASH sector. And when we participate in the global WASH sector, we only do that as a funder. We never look back at ourselves and say, like, okay, what about the millions of people we have in the US that don't have access to water? So I think we need to do more to take that kind of sector-based approach in the United States. And you can see the first little sparkles of that happening around the edges of this movement. There is an organization now called VESSEL, the VESSEL Collective, which I think has 15 organizations in it now focused on domestic WASH issues. And they're hosting their first conference this year. And I think after that, there may be more and more organizations joining that collective and interfacing more deeply with communities and with government. So there's hope that we'll take that approach and that approach will help keep big actors accountable to the communities that don't have access to water. But it's early, you know, I'm really hopeful, but it's early.
What was that organization called?
It's called the VESSEL Collective.
And
we've been part of it for the last couple of years, but it's being organized by a bunch of different organizations from the domestic space and also some international WASH players that build systems in places like, I don't know, India and Latin America that are just based in the US.
Mm. This is probably a Pandora's box comment, but I actually grew up in a very rural community and we were really close to a Navy base. And so they were practicing touch and goes in our community. And the fire retardants actually got into our water supply. And it's like the small community of 1,200 people going up against the military and the Navy and saying like, hey, do you mind cleaning this up?
Yeah, interestingly, I also grew up in rural America. I grew up in a town of like 700 people in Wisconsin.
Oh, wow.
And my dad was in the Navy. So I got some connections there too. But yeah, I think this is one of the emerging challenges that we're seeing across the country. PFAS and PFOS, these forever chemicals that are in things like fire retardants, in firefighting foam, they seep into the water supply and they're basically impossible to clean, impossible to get out of water using the technology we have now. And we know they're linked to things like cancer. So we're just getting, for the first time, some EPA rules around, you know, how much of these chemicals is acceptable in drinking water in order for us to call it clean. And what do we need to be doing to approach this from a policy perspective? And what new technologies are on the horizon to help us mitigate the impacts of this stuff? But yeah, you're right. That is a big topic of discussion and debate right now. It's a whole it's a whole nother thing, but it's so important.
Mm, yeah. And before I ask you our last question, because we're about to come to a close, I was wondering if there's anything else that I didn't ask you or didn't touch upon that you feel is really important in your work and would want to share with our audience.
Oh, yeah. You asked me impact stories earlier from the field, and I give you a bunch from Navajo. There are some incredible stories from Appalachia, from Texas, from other communities that we visited in places like Alaska and Alabama. But often I don't get time to talk about the impact our work has on staff here at Dig Deep. Mm-hmm. And I was just working this week with a staff member named Shelby, who is on our Dig Deep Labs team. And Dig Deep Labs is sort of our research and data hub. They do our monitoring and evaluation for our projects, but they also publish big national studies like the one I mentioned on economic impacts or on climate change, and a lot of technological research and these learning cohorts between impacted communities. It's really cool work. And Shelby is one of those 40% of Dig Deep employees that has lived without running water herself. She comes from the Navajo Nation. You know, growing up, she hauled water so her grandmother could take a bath. And I have been, you know, working with her. Well, really, she's been working with our team in Appalachia to take some of the work we've been doing in off-grid homes on Navajo, where we deliver water by tanker to a house. And like I mentioned earlier, store it underground in a tank and then pump it into the house using solar power. And she's been working to adapt that technology using our research to Appalachia, where it can run on rainwater instead of groundwater. And this project is so cool. And I think what's made Dig Deep successful at solving this big, hairy challenge when a lot of other people have tried and failed, or sometimes started talking about it and not even tried because they're so daunted by how complicated it is. What makes us successful, you know, is the fact that we are powered by the Shelbys of the world, you know, by people who take this so seriously and for whom it's so personal, but who believe ultimately that sort of anything is figure-outable, like anything is possible. And that spirit, like, oh my God, there's so, it brings us all so much joy and we get so much done every day. And that's not to say it's not also very hard work and very emotionally challenging work sometimes too, but wow. When you're approaching it from that really personal place and when you know that your coworkers have been so deeply impacted, like it feels great.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I love that. And I can just hear in all of your stories and through looking through your website and all the projects that you've done and all of the documents that you have linked there, there's so much creativity, which I love to see because with all of the climate change and the, you know, the inequities we have, there needs to be really creative solutions. And I think you've kind of discovered that, which is amazing.
Thanks.
Yeah, of course. So lastly, we ask all of our guests to finish the following sentence. The future is blank.
Do you know that that Natasha Bedingfield song? The rest is still unwritten.
Yeah, I do know that one.
Yeah, I feel like the future is whatever we choose. Mm. I think especially when we're facing big questions like water access, climate change, the future of democracy, people get so down because they feel so, I don't know, powerless against these massive structures that are causing these inequities, especially structural inequities. But if Dig Deep has proven anything in the past, what, 13 years that I've been doing this job, it's that if you have this spirit of creativity and a lot of patience and a little bit of intelligence, you can really do anything. So many of us, even the people on this team that were born with the least privilege, have some sort of agency that we can put into this work. And when we do that collectively, we can get anything done. I mean, we saw a sitting U.S. Vice President, Kamala Harris, 2 weeks ago say that water is a basic human right that every American should have for the first time. It's the first time someone from the U.S. government had ever said that out loud. Wow. And a lot went into creating the atmosphere where she could say that, right? A lot of research had to be published. A lot of stories had to be told. A lot of work had to be done on the ground. And, you know, if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I probably would have naively said, like, yeah, we'll get there. But I would have only half believed it. But the truth is that the future is whatever we want it to be. It just depends on how hard we're willing to work and how much we're willing to work together.
Amazing. Perfect answer. And you brought in a song lyric from my childhood. So I love that.
Yeah. Give you something to play in the background of the episode.
Yeah, exactly. Well, George, thank you so much. This was an amazing conversation. Like I said, well worth the wait. Thank you for sharing all of your work. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing. It's really incredible and very, very much needed.
Thanks, Amanda. Thanks for your hard work. And thanks to all your listeners who are going to get involved now. I can't wait to meet you.